Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Neil Jacobstein to the broadcast. Neil is the co-chair of the Artificial Intelligence and Robotics track within Singularity University, a Silicon Valley think tank founded in 2008 at NASA's Research Park in California, focusing on educational programs and exponential technologies. Prior to his current role, Neil served as president of the university from October 2010 to October of 2011. He's also served as a technical consultant on AI research and development projects for DARPA, Boeing, NIST, and other organizations. He was also CEO of Technology Corporation, a pioneering AI company that worked on AI application systems for industry and government. Neil earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Sciences from the University of Wisconsin and his Master's of Science degree in Human Ecology from the University of Texas. I recently caught up with Neil, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed how individuals can prepare themselves for the coming wave of AI, and Principle 2, Infrastructure, as we discussed his perspectives on the dangers of artificial intelligence that have been expressed by major thought leaders. We also discussed the way that AI can be used to augment current human capabilities, the role government may play in mitigating the potential for AI-caused job loss, and how individuals can prepare themselves for the opportunities for AI in the future, among other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Neil Jacobstein, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. I would love to begin with your role at Singularity University and perhaps a little bit about the university itself. You are a past president of the university from 2010 to 2011. You are currently co-chair of the Artificial Intelligence and Robotics track at the university. Can you take a moment to describe the university as well as your role in it?
Yes, Singularity University started on the NASA Research Park campus around 2008. We had our first graduate summer program in 2009. And the university's purpose is to help leaders utilize and understand the business, technical, and ethical implications of exponential technologies. These are technologies that increase in price performance every 18 to 24 months. Examples would include artificial intelligence, robotics, synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and some other technologies that depend on those. Biology, for example, has become an information science, and it's now growing in capability on an exponential curve. And we bring in leaders from around the world to attend our executive programs that are given every couple months or so. Usually there are about 80 to 100 people in those executive programs, and they last about 5 days. And then we have a 9-week-long summer program that we've conducted every summer since 2009, and typically there are 80 people in that summer program. Oftentimes they have won their seat in that program by winning a contest in their country. I'm proud that we now have slightly more women in the program than we have men. We have a very good ratio now, finally, and we have people from 40 plus countries represented, and they are absolutely top students, super competitive students. They can't buy their way in. The program is sponsored by Google and other companies in other ways, and they live on the NASA Research Park campus here at Moffett Field, and they first are exposed to a few weeks of exponential technologies, including AI, robotics, synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and other technologies that depend on those, like energy and manufacturing, 3D printing, and medicine. And then they address building next generation businesses with each other, and not just businesses, but also nonprofit entities. They form teams and they use principles that include crowdsourcing and being able to build and scale entities very rapidly. So that may be of interest to your Forbes readers. They're using the principles of exponential organizations, and they then address global grand challenges. And these challenges are things like climate change and education and poverty and global health, energy and security. And those kind of challenges really require the scale that exponential technologies can provide. And the students in their teams, it might be up to 20 different teams, are coached by a wide variety of faculty and staff during the summer program. They then go on to perhaps join an incubator program that we have on campus if they meet certain thresholds. And we've had several successful businesses spin out every year. We are very proud of the program. I think that we're getting better at it every year.
You mentioned the Exponential Organization, a book by that name, Exponential Organizations. Interestingly enough, in the book, it's noted that AI and algorithms could be used to mitigate and compensate for heuristics in human cognition, such as anchoring bias or availability bias, confirmation bias, sunk cost bias, others like that. As an expert in AI personally, I wonder if you could take a moment just to describe that insight, but also the way in which AI and algorithms, more generally speaking, can mitigate those issues.
Well, a couple different ways. I think that it's less direct now than it will be in the future, but we're able to have AI be a partner in decision making. One can imagine an organization that has committed itself to evidence-based decision-making as opposed to relying on the hunches of managers and board members. And if the organization has committed itself to evidence-based decision-making and they use AI for pattern recognition, they can do, I think, a much better job in avoiding bias and in paying attention to patterns in the world that humans unaided would have difficulty seeing. One can also use AI to identify counterfactuals to the assertions that people make. So if you have a list that a decision is dependent on, you can identify counterfactuals and you can use AI to do that, and you can use AI to build with a simulation model, build a model that has all of the weak links in the evidence-based chain highlighted. An example of something that we didn't do back in the NASA Challenger days, you may recall that in that case, that decision was taken when a launch had been delayed several times, and it was a lot of pressure to launch. It was a cold day. There was an inconvenient memo from an engineer that said during cold weather conditions, you may experience cracks in the O-rings. associated with the launch vehicle, and that could be hazardous. And the team at Morton Thiokol and perhaps some representatives from NASA decided that they should just push forward. And they weighted the pressure to launch higher than it should have been weighted under the circumstances. And the astronauts died. And after that disaster, to NASA's credit, they revisited their launch decision protocol, and they cleaned that up considerably and changed their decision-making procedures. So they didn't use AI immediately after that. They used good old-fashioned human decision-making, but they were much more careful about that. And I believe that in the future, one can be aided by simulation and artificial intelligence to check the assumptions that the humans are making. And I think that will happen more and more frequently. The military certainly has been doing that for a long time.
Many in the media portray AI robotics as sort of a us versus them, humans versus machines. And I've read that you've indicated that our neocortex, which hasn't really changed in the past 50,000 years and is the size of a napkin, through the use of AI and other emerging technologies would allow us to expand that to the size of a tablecloth or even larger. And I wonder, I'd love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, well, let me just correct some things that someone listening might not completely understand. The brain has changed over the last 50,000 years, but very slowly. The basic architecture remains the same, and that architecture is even older than 50,000 years, and it evolved under very different circumstances than the ones that we have today. The selection pressures from millions of years ago and certainly 50,000 years ago were totally different than the ones that we see today, with torrents of bits, millions of bits coming at people, and the information processing demands of today are really extreme, and they call for some kind of augmentation. The notion about the brain being the size of a dinner napkin, a large dinner napkin, that refers to the surface area of the neocortex. It's not the size of the entire brain. And in the other comment about making the surface area of a neocortex larger, it's not referring to making the human's neocortex surface area larger. It's referring to the ability to emulate the neocortex or mimic some of the behavior of the neocortex, the pattern recognition behavior and problem-solving behavior. And once we build artificial neocortex, and in some respects we have in weak forms, we can expand its surface area to the equivalent of a large tablecloth or the size of a room or the size of a city or larger. In other words, you can make it arbitrarily large with the computing fabric that you have available. I hope that clarifies that.
It does indeed. And I was asking that actually on the heels of the response you gave a moment ago, because it really is that sort of the human mind working in concert with the technology that allows us to process in some really interesting and new ways, if I'm understanding
you
correctly.
You are. And in fact, the notion that I like to provide people with, both in business contexts and during more academic programs that we have during the summer, is that they should think of AI as an augmentation capability, as a partner to the human information processing. It has other strengths. It's faster. It can deal with a lot more information, longer retention and memory. And it's a way for people to augment their decision-making capability and their brains without changing the brain itself. We may do that using synthetic biology at some time, but for the time being, I think the practical way to augment the brain is to use artificial intelligence and machine learning.
Indeed. And you obviously, through Singularity University and beyond, have exposure to a number of cutting edge organizations that are in business in AI and robotics and innovating in a lot of really interesting and exciting ways. For listeners who may be technology executives in more traditional companies, I'd be curious about your thoughts about the strategies that you'd recommend they think about in approaching AI. Some of what we're describing is really in its infancy, but nevertheless, the value one can derive is already arriving in many cases. So at the risk of asking you a rather general question, where you've seen large organizations that maybe don't have AI investments of their own, don't have AI departments necessarily, but are beginning to partner with the kinds of companies you've been exposed to, how have you seen those work well?
Sure. I also work as a visiting scholar at Stanford University, and I've seen some examples there, and also consult at the Harris Center for Precision Wellness in Mount Sinai in New York, and consult for Deloitte and other organizations. So over the last 25 years or so, I really have seen a lot of examples of AI augmenting businesses in various ways. Let me give you a few examples. One is the ability to repurpose drugs. So if you have access to tumor sequences and you have access to the genomes of people that have cancer, you can understand, you can use machine learning to look for targets, surface cell antigens that are similar between a tumor found in one place and a tumor found in another. You might find that the tumor has migrated, the same tumor family has migrated. And if that particular surface cell antigen is the same, you might get similar results with the same drug that's been approved for one purpose and repurpose it for another purpose. And some really excellent work by Joel Dudley and Atul Butte at Stanford allowed that to happen numerous times. Joel is also doing that now in the Mount Sinai context. Another example, in fact, multiple examples of consumer product companies that have a mix of inputs that are for a food product or a beverage, and they depend on a variety of beans or nuts or products that are from agriculture, and they buy those in large quantities. And you can use AI to change the feed mix and keep the acidity of the, say, a beverage product the same, the aroma the same, everything exactly the same from a consumer point of view, the health aspects the same, but use different beans depending on their price. And that's possible with a wide variety of both consumer products and industrial products. And that's just another way that you can use AI and machine learning effectively to help a business be more effective. Another example of that in the financial world is there's now a widespread use of AI in what's called fintech or in the financial sector. We actually run a conference, Singularity University runs a conference on the it's called Exponential Finance, and it's run every year around June in New York. And the conference focuses on many examples of AI and machine learning being used by the financial industry to help people make financial decisions, whether it's helping traders make financial decisions at lightning speed or helping individuals get access to really informed financial advice that is shaped by their preferences and their risk profile. And those so-called robo-advisors have become very popular, and they're being used by virtually every large financial institution. Charles Schwab, for example, when they launched their system, got a 20% uptick in the number of people that were using their financial advice, and many of them were new to Charles Schwab, so they were there because of the robo-advisor. So those are just a few. I might keep going if you'd like.
I think those are great examples. Your example of the robo-advisor does bring to mind the fact that technology is in many cases replacing human work. Not that that's necessarily such a new concept. That's been going on in various ways for quite some time. And I don't imagine that somebody who's been a financial advisor would necessarily have a difficult time pivoting to something complementary to what the technology is taking over. Nevertheless, I'd be interested in your perspectives about how much concern one should have, as well as maybe even the government's role in thinking about jobs that will likely go away, perhaps en masse, as a result of some of the innovations we're describing.
Yes, it's a great question. I think that prudent and proactive planning is called for, but not panic and hysteria. And I think we've seen too much of the latter and not enough of the former. Let me be very specific about this. I think that you can think of AI as augmentation when it comes to robo-advice, or it can completely replace an advisor. And in many cases, people want a human touch when they are making decisions. They want to be able to talk about their grandchildren. They want to be able to talk about their spouses and future planning. And AIs are really not up to the task of understanding family dynamics and tone of voice and the subtle aspects of human communication. So many of the financial robo-advisors are actually white labeled by financial institutions, and the front interface to the client is through a human being who's being augmented by these robo advisors, and that gives them higher productivity, deeper insight, etc. So not all the financial advisors will lose their jobs over this, although some will. So let's talk about the case of people losing their jobs. I think that it's easy for technology folks who have jobs to be blasé about this, but I think it is a big deal. And in the past, people could always, for example, in the transition from farming to working in factories, people could just repurpose their brains and their muscles to do something different. They didn't have to use as much muscle. They used more brain power. They got trained to work in factories, and that transition went fairly well. The transition from the factory to more white-collar work likewise meant even less muscle in the equation for many people, and more training, college perhaps, or a technical trade school, and people ended up doing more white-collar work. But when white-collar work itself is being disrupted, then I think you'll see both AI being used as a partner to people to vastly increase their productivity. And that's a very viable way to go. And it means that many people will stay employed and they'll be considerably more productive. But it also means that people who are doing very routine jobs, and there are many people who do very routine jobs, both in the United States, in the UK, in Europe, in general, and particularly in developing countries where the ratio of routine jobs to extraordinarily skilled jobs is very different. Far more people employed doing routine jobs. And there you have a lot more risk of automation. And there, I think the key strategy is education and teaming with machines rather than racing against them, racing with them, teaming with them, and using them to augment human cognition. And I think that if people do that, and also if governments are more proactive about providing universal education for people, and that's becoming easier and easier thanks to the web and AI, I think we'll be able to help people get better and better at adapting to new jobs, at innovating new jobs. I think we'll be able to coach people about innovation, building new possibilities. So there is a whole world of potential that we haven't tapped yet to create new jobs around improving the environment. The oceans are a mess. We could have a lot more people employed in cleaning up the oceans. We could have a lot more people employed in taking care of old people and taking care of young people. So there are many things that we could do if we were creative and proactive about it. Let me make a few more quick points. AI and other exponential technologies like robotics and synthetic biology and eventually nanotechnology or precision manufacturing are going to create huge amounts of wealth. I mean, really astronomical amounts of wealth. And that will allow us, even if we kept the tax base at exactly the same percentage, we could garner a lot more money to distribute wealth to the people that need it. I'm not talking about socialism here. I'm not talking about equalizing the playing field when people work harder, or they do things that are really creative. I think it's very important for them to be rewarded as they are in the capitalist system, and I am a capitalist. But I do think that it's important to put a net under misery and to make sure that our fellow human beings, if we can afford it, and I think, A, we can afford it now, and we certainly can afford it in the future, we ought to work very hard to make sure that people have access to first-class education, first-class healthcare, which, by the way, AI is also making more available through mobile health capabilities, access to shelter, which 3D printing and other technologies besides 3D printing, which tends to be applied at the small scale, will be able to help us provide. So I think if we could provide education, healthcare, and shelter, and do so economically, we will still have a world of unequal distribution of wealth. But instead of having a world of have-nots and haves, we can have a world of haves and super-haves. And I think that that would make a much more stable and safe world for everyone. I'll just point out that we've run the experiment of keeping large amounts of people in poverty and misery. And as you can see from the news, they become targets for radicalization. And it really doesn't work out well for them. And it doesn't work out well for rich people either. So I think it's in our enlightened long-term self-interest to make sure that everybody is reasonably well taken care of.
You mentioned through the course of your response that there are a number of people who are sounding alarm bells of various levels of volume with regard to some of the safety concerns of AI, but preeminent thinkers like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and Nick Bostrom, to name three. Do you feel as though the concerns are overblown at this point?
Well, I know Nick and Elon, and I think that in their cases, certainly what they are doing, let me just mention the work of Nick Bostrom, which I think is large, productive. I mean, I think that what Nick is doing is not sounding the alarms around today's AI, and people often confuse that or blur that distinction. He's referring to the capabilities of a future superintelligence. And what he's basically saying is not that we shouldn't develop it, but rather that we should be proactive about engineering safety features into these systems so that they do what we want them to do rather than just run off the rails. Nick and Elon were both with us at a conference that Elon and Nick and Jan Tallinn all helped put together in San Juan, Puerto Rico in January of 2015. They invited about 50 AI researchers, and we spent 3 days together examining the risks of AI and working on ways that we could address those risks directly. And we identified 4 key areas that were a good start on the R&D. One is verification, making sure that the AI software meets a specific spec and that it meets that spec with high fidelity. The second one is validation, making sure that the spec itself is valid and has no loopholes for malicious behavior, and doing that with mathematical proofs. The third area is security, securing the system from being hacked from within or without. And then the fourth area is control, assuming that something eventually goes wrong, and it often does, having a dozen redundant, layered ways to reestablish control. So that's not the whole story on safety engineering, but it's a good start. And the importance of doing that and making sure that we think carefully about the ethics of AI as we move forward is what's required to be the stewards and entrepreneurs around powerful technologies. This is also true for synthetic biology or nanotech or robotics. These technologies all come with powerful upsides and potentially powerful downsides. And what we're after is being able to get the upside to manage the downside risk. And that requires work. Just like when you deal with fire, if you use a gas range in your house, they're still fashionable in some houses. They have some risks associated with them. And you have to be careful about how you use them. That doesn't mean you don't use them. It means that you accept the responsibility for using them wisely, and perhaps you put in fire extinguishers and heat sensors and smoke detectors in your house to make sure that you can respond quickly if something begins going awry. And the particular challenge with superintelligence is we want to be able to respond in blinding fast time. And that means that we're going to have AIs that are monitoring AIs. And if you think that notion is bizarre, we're already doing it. We've already begun running this experiment, our antivirus software, which is running on your laptop and mine. And it's AI code that is monitoring for little snippets of AI, which we call viruses or worms. The endeavor is not perfect, but by and large, we're able to operate our computing machinery and our networks with pretty good fidelity, in spite of the fact that there are a few people that build malicious software and try to take down these systems. Occasionally, they're successful, but by and large, we're able to move forward. And I think that we're going to see something similar to that in the predator-prey fashion that we see happening in the viruses and worms and antivirus malicious software world, where there's innovation on both sides, and in predator-prey fashion, there's response to innovation. The good news is that there's a lot more energy and intellect, orders of magnitude more energy and intellect on the side of people building up the world and defending civilization than there is on the side of people tearing down the world and building malicious software or AI. And I think because of that ratio, we're going to do okay. We won't live in a perfect world, but I think we'll live in a world, frankly, that's a lot better, cleaner, safer, healthier than the one that we live in today.
As somebody who thinks so much about artificial intelligence, thinks about the possibility of routinized tasks being taken over by technology, I wonder how this applies even in your personal life. Do you find yourself, as you're going through your average day, contemplating tasks of your own that you really oughtn't be doing, or situations where it would be helpful to have a technology doing the sorts of things you've been doing your entire life? I'd be curious how somebody who is so immersed in this world and so up to date on where the innovation is taking place, how this begins to color your experience on a day-to-day basis.
Yes. So long ago, I stopped thinking about AIs and machine intelligence as just a tool that you have to tell it everything that you want it to do. You know, when you open up a standard toolbox with wrenches and saws and drills and screwdrivers and things. You basically provide all the brain power for that, and it helps extend your capabilities. But with AI and machine learning, we're able to delegate work to these systems, and the classes of work that we delegate can scale and eventually increase in variety. And that's been true for some time now, and the variety of tasks that you can delegate really has increased. If you think about what you can ask the assistant technology that we have today, it's very rudimentary, like Siri or Google Now or Alexa from Amazon or Cortana from Microsoft. These are all examples of assistant technology where you really can delegate very simple tasks to them. You can ask them to look something up for you. You can ask them to do relatively simple things. But one could imagine using a scheduling agent. There's one called Amy that's able to do, I would say, moderately complex scheduling tasks, and is not particularly adept at doing complex scheduling tasks yet, but eventually will be, or some other scheduling agent will be. And so I think that we're moving from a world where we think of AIs as tools and moving into a world where we think of AIs as assistants and associates. Long ago, the Air Force had a program called the Pilot's Associate, where a lot of the piloting was being taken over by an AI assistant. And now we have cars. My car, for example, from Tesla, uses first order or simple self-driving capabilities. It's not fully automated. I can't just tell it to take me somewhere. But it does allow me to delegate some of the stop-and-go driving tasks to it, and it does it pretty well. And the Google self-driving car really is a self-driving car. I was in the back seat of one several years ago, the beta version of it. And it was very competent. It did have a human driver just to make sure that the system didn't go off the rails, but the human driver only was asked by the system to touch the wheel once when it wanted to merge for the Google exit, and it couldn't get the eye contact of other drivers. But by and large, the Google self-driving car is a great example of being able to delegate work that we humans used to do and do it with a higher safety record than humans have. I mean, that self-driving car has gone well over 1 million miles with an outstanding safety record. And currently people in the U.S., we kill 33,000 people a year, and around the world, 1.2 million people a year in car accidents. But these accidents are largely avoidable, and they are the result of drunk driving or distracted driving. And we could do an amazing job of bringing that kind of statistic down to delegate the driving tasks that we have to humans. And certainly pilots who pilot commercial airlines delegate most of their piloting tasks now to autopilot.
Great examples. I'm curious, as you speak with executives at large organizations, again, who are in the process of thinking about the application of the innovation we're describing back to their enterprises, is there training that you advise that, for instance, IT workers within those organizations increasingly take to be cognizant of and best suited to adopt the kind of innovation that we're describing?
Yes. So there are a whole set of things that corporations do. One of them is to embed themselves into a innovation context like Singularity University's corporate labs program, or a program like that where they can live in a deep innovation community with lots of players and lots of ideas flying around that are productive and pruned, and where there is a disciplined approach to doing exponential innovation or innovation around exponential technologies. The other thing that they can do is, in the area of AI in particular, is to ask people who are interested in AI to go to our programs, our executive program, or apply for a summer program, or go to a summit that we now have around the world. And there are many other opportunities. For example, Coursera and Udacity and Khan Academy and edX all have excellent AI programs. Often you can take those for free and just pay if you want certification. It's possible to study at home by just downloading the R programming kit, which is available on the web, and you can practice machine learning at home using a laptop. And if you don't have the programming skills for that, you can use RStudio, which helps tame some of the rough edges of R. Or if you still don't have the programming skills for RStudio, you can ask a high school student to sit with you and help coach you on this. So there are many different ways to get started. Another way to get started is to use a platform like IBM Watson, which is a very capable platform and is applicable to multiple areas. You can use a platform like Sentient, and you can use eventually a platform from Viv, V-I-V Labs. They are still in development, but I think they're going to have a very capable platform. So the meaning of a platform is that a lot of the infrastructure programming has been done for you if you work inside of a corporation, and that means that you can start at a higher level of abstraction and get started immediately applying a system like Watson or Sentient or Viv to your particular problem, and you can do so at scale and perhaps roll out your solution globally. So I think that there are many opportunities to move quickly in this arena and to do it responsibly and to do it in a cost-effective way. And there are many consultants around the world that can help them do that. There are both internal consultants inside of a company. For example, General Electric has an amazingly capable AI group that's been around for a while and really has done some great things. There are great AI groups in all of the auto companies now, GM, Ford, Toyota, et cetera. And they often have lab programs that allow people from other parts of the corporation that are not involved in AI to sit with them and address new problems with them.
Neil, we've been talking a lot about the enterprise implications of AI and some great advice you've given as to how executives of those organizations might prepare themselves for the opportunities that you've been describing. But I'd love to talk a little bit more about we as individuals. I'm curious about how individuals might prepare themselves. And at the same time, especially as we're talking about some of the opportunities versus some of the safety issues, how you would suggest a parent work with their children in light of the eventualities that we're describing here?
So let's take the last part of the question. I think that parents can encourage their children to develop a love of learning. That's perhaps the most important thing. And also an appreciation for the importance of critical thinking. And that starts, I think, around the dinner table and just traveling in the car places or walking through the woods, helping children develop critical thinking skills and challenging them to do that so that it's a habit. Critical thinking skills are not going to be devalued anytime soon because they really are important. And also the ability to ask and frame entirely new questions. We don't do a good job in schools helping children really think about what does it take to frame a new question that has weight and significance. And I think that children are fully capable of doing that if they're coached on how to do that. The other thing is, I think that for the world that's coming of exponential technologies, not just in AI, but in robotics, synthetic biology, nanotech, medicine, and others, it's very important for children to get a really deep grounding in STEM education and science, and technology, engineering, and math. That may sound daunting, but if students are given a love of learning, if that's communicated to them well, if the programs are engaging that they're involved in, they will really enjoy learning, and getting a deep grounding in science and math and other areas. And I would also say in ethics, I've noticed that a whole generation has grown up where they don't get ethics in school, because we don't typically teach ethics in the high school and below grades. And they often have stopped going to Sunday school or Saturday school, and they sometimes don't get ethics over the dinner table. So where are they going to get it? And if they don't get it, it's going to be a problem for our society. So I think it's very important to teach ethics at an early age, not necessarily imbued with religion, but certainly in the context of practical problem solving and situations that people deal with in everyday life, and in the kind of situations we may have to deal with in the future scenarios. We do that at Singularity University in our workshops for executives, and also for our programs for the students over the summer in our Global Solutions program. Another aspect of this is that people often ask, how do you deal with the scary parts of AI, or AI's getting out of control? And I mentioned to you that there's a whole community now that's engaged in that dialogue, a community in the AI world. There's a ethics committee at the AAAI, the Association for the Advancement of AI, that takes these questions seriously. There are people writing books and articles on safety engineering around AI. And it's important for people to know that the AI community is not ignoring these issues. But it's also important to know that Hollywood movie studios are very good at scaring people, because they sell tickets that way. People like the thrill of an epinephrine rush or an endorphin rush that goes with being scared, and they like having their nervous systems hijacked for an hour and a half. And that's the way you sell tickets. And it's important for people to realize that Hollywood does not have any particular commitment to fidelity and balance in their portrayal of AIs. People often ask me what keeps me up at night, and I tell them that I don't stay up at night worrying about AI or machine learning. I stay up at night worrying about human stupidity and meanness and irrationality. So I think it's important to put these issues in perspective and to take a strong stand in favor of people acting in ways that are rational and ethical, and figuring that if we do that consistently, our AIs will have a much greater chance of doing that, particularly if we do a good job at safety engineering.
Great advice all around. Neil Jacobstein, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives here on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a fascinating conversation.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.